read and reread his careful explanations. After a few weeks of this, by magic or miracle, the concepts took hold. I retook the practice test. The advanced algebra was still indecipherable. It came from a world beyond my ability to perceive, but the trigonometry had become intelligible. Messages written in a language I could understand, from a world of logic and order that only existed in black ink and on white paper. The real world, meanwhile, plunged into chaos. The doctors told Mother that Sean's injury might have altered his personality, that in the hospital he had shown tendencies toward volatility, even violence, and that such changes might be permanent. He did succumb to rages, moments of blind anger when all he wanted was to hurt someone. He had an intuition for nastiness, for saying the single most devastating thing that left Mother in tears more nights than not. These rages changed and worsened as his physical strength improved, and I found myself cleaning the toilet every morning, knowing my head might be inside it before lunch. Mother said I was the only one who could calm him, and I persuaded myself that that was true. Who better, I thought. He doesn't affect me. Reflecting on it now, I'm not sure the injury changed him that much, but I convinced myself that it had, and that any cruelty on his part was entirely new. I can read my journals from this period and trace the evolution of a young girl rewriting her history. In the reality she constructed for herself, nothing had been wrong before her brother fell off that pallet. "I wish I had my best friend back," she wrote. "Before his injury, I never got hurt at all." Chapter 15. No More a Child. There was a moment that winter. I was kneeling on the carpet, listening to Dad testify of Mother's calling as a healer, when my breath caught in my chest and I felt taken out of myself. I no longer saw my parents or our living room. What I saw was a woman grown, with her own mind, her own prayers, who no longer sat childlike at her father's feet. I saw the woman's swollen belly, and it was my belly. Next to her sat her mother, the midwife. She took her mother's hand and said she wanted the baby delivered in a hospital by a doctor. "I'll drive you," her mother said. The woman moved toward the door, but the door was blocked by loyalty, by obedience, by her father. He stood immovable. But the woman was his daughter, and she had drawn to herself all his conviction, all his weightiness. She set him aside and moved through the door. I tried to imagine what future such a woman might claim for herself. I tried to conjure other scenes in which she and her father were of two minds, when she ignored his counsel and kept her own. But my father had taught me that there are not two reasonable opinions to be had on any subject. There is truth, and there are lies. I knelt on the carpet, listening to my father, but studying this stranger, and felt suspended between them, drawn to each, repelled by both. I understood that no future could hold them. No destiny could tolerate him and her. I would remain a child in perpetuity, always, or I would lose him. I was lying on my bed, watching the shadows my feeble lamp cast on the ceiling, when I heard my father's voice at the door. Instinctively, I jerked to my feet in a kind of salute, but once I was standing, I wasn't sure what to do. There was no precedent for this. My father had never visited my room before. He strode past me and sat on my bed, then patted the mattress next to him. I took my seat, nervously, my feet barely touching the floor. I waited for him to speak, but the moments passed silently. His eyes were closed, his jaw slackened, as if he were listening to seraphic voices.
"I've been praying," he said.
His voice was soft, a loving voice.
"I've been praying about your decision to go to college."
His eyes opened. His pupils had dilated in the lamplight, absorbing the hazel of the iris. I'd never seen eyes so given over to blackness. They seemed unearthly, tokens of spiritual power.
"The Lord has called me to testify," he said. "He is displeased. You have cast aside his blessings to whore after man's knowledge. His wrath is stirred against you. It will not be long in coming."
I don't remember my father standing to leave, but he must have, while I sat, gripped by fear. God's wrath had laid waste to cities. It had flooded the whole earth. I felt weak, then wholly powerless. I remembered that my life was not mine. I could be taken out of my body at any moment, dragged heavenward to reckon with a furious father. The next morning, I found Mother mixing oils in the kitchen. "I've decided not to go to BYU," I said. She looked up, fixing her eyes on the wall behind me, and whispered, "Don't say that. I don't want to hear that." I didn't understand. I'd thought she would be glad to see me yield to God. Her gaze shifted to me. I hadn't felt its strength in years, and I was stunned by it. "Of all my children," she said, "you were the one I thought would burst out of here in a blaze. I didn't expect it from Tyler. That was a surprise. But you, don't you stay. Go. Don't let anything stop you from going." I heard Dad's step on the stairwell. Mother sighed, and her eyes fluttered, as if she were coming out of a trance. Dad took his seat at the kitchen table, and Mother stood to fix his breakfast. He began a lecture about liberal professors, and Mother mixed batter for pancakes, periodically murmuring in agreement. Without Sean as foreman, Dad's construction business dwindled. I'd quit my job at Randy's to look after Sean. Now I needed money, so when Dad went back to scrapping that winter, so did I. It was an icy morning, much like the first, when I returned to the junkyard. It had changed. There were still pillars of mangled cars, but they no longer dominated the landscape. A few years before, Dad had been hired by Utah Power to dismantle hundreds of utility towers. He had been allowed to keep the angle iron, and it was now stacked, 400,000 pounds of it, in tangled mountains all over the yard. I woke up every morning at 6 to study, because it was easier to focus in the mornings before I was worn out from scrapping. Although I was still fearful of God's wrath, I reasoned with myself that my passing the ACT was so unlikely it would take an act of God. And if God acted, then surely my going to school was his will. The ACT was composed of 4 sections: math, English, science, and reading. My math skills were improving, but they were not strong. While I could answer most of the questions on the practice exam, I was slow, needing double or triple the allotted time. I lacked even a basic knowledge of grammar, though I was learning, beginning with nouns and moving on to prepositions and gerunds. Science was a mystery, perhaps because the only science book I'd ever read had had detachable pages for coloring. Of the 4 sections, reading was the only one about which I felt confident. BYU was a competitive school. I'd need a high score, a 27 at least, which meant the top 15% of my cohort. I was 16, had never taken an exam, and had only recently undertaken anything like a systematic education. Still, I registered for the test. It felt like throwing dice, like the roll was out of my hands. God would score the toss. I didn't sleep the night before. My brain conjured so many scenes of disaster, it burned as if with a fever. At 5, I got out of bed, ate breakfast, and drove the 40 miles to Utah State University. I was led into a white classroom with 30 other students who took their seats and placed their pencils on their desks. A middle-aged woman handed out tests and strange pink sheets I'd never seen before. "Excuse me," I said when she gave me mine. "What is this?" "It's a bubble sheet to mark your answers." "How does it work?" I said. "It's the same as any other bubble sheet." She began to move away from me, visibly irritated, as if I were playing a prank. I've never used one before. She appraised me for a moment. Fill in the bubble of the correct answer, she said. Blacken it completely. Understand? The test began. I'd never sat at a desk for 4 hours in a room full of people. The noise was unbelievable, yet I seemed to be the only person who heard it, who couldn't divert her attention from the rustle of turning pages and the scratch of pencils on paper. When it was over, I suspected that I'd failed the math, and I was positive that I'd failed the science. My answers for the science portion couldn't even be called guesses. They were random, just patterns of dots on that strange pink sheet. I drove home. I felt stupid. But more than stupid, I felt ridiculous. Now that I'd seen the other students, watched them march into the classroom in neat rows, claim their seats, and calmly fill in their answers as if they were performing a practiced routine, it seemed absurd that I had thought I could score in the top 15%. That was their world. I stepped into overalls and returned to mine. There was an unusually hot day that spring, and Luke and I spent it hauling purlins, the iron beams that run horizontally along the length of a roof. The purlins were heavy and the sun relentless. Sweat dripped from our noses and onto the painted iron. Luke slipped out of his shirt, grabbed hold of the sleeves, and tore them, leaving huge gashes a breeze could pass through. I wouldn't have dreamed of doing anything so radical, but after the 20th purlin, my back was sticky with sweat, and I flapped my t-shirt to make a fan, then rolled up my sleeves until an inch of my shoulders was visible. When Dad saw me a few minutes later, he strode over and yanked the sleeves down.
"This ain't a whorehouse," he said.
I watched him walk away, and mechanically, as if I weren't making the decision, re-rolled them. He returned an hour later, and when he caught sight of me, he paused mid-step, confused. He'd told me what to do, and I hadn't done it. He stood uncertainly for a moment, then crossed over to me, took hold of both sleeves, and jerked them down. He didn't make it 10 steps before I'd rolled them up again. I wanted to obey. I meant to. But the afternoon was so hot, the breeze on my arms so welcome. It was just a few inches. I was covered from my temples to my toes in grime. It would take me half an hour that night to dig the black dirt out of my nostrils and ears. I didn't feel much like an object of desire or temptation. I felt like a human forklift. How could an inch of skin matter? I was hoarding my paychecks in case I needed the money for tuition. Dad noticed and started charging me for small things. Mother had gone back to buying insurance after the second car accident, and Dad said I should pay my share, so I did. Then he wanted more for registration.
"These government fees will break you," he said as I handed him the cash.
That satisfied Dad until my test results arrived. I returned from the junkyard to find a white envelope. I tore it open, staining the page with grease, and looked past the individual scores to the composite. 22. My heart was beating loud, happy beats. It wasn't a 27, but it opened up possibilities. Maybe Idaho State. I showed Mother the score, and she told Dad. He became agitated. Then he shouted that it was time I moved out.
"If she's old enough to pull a paycheck, she's old enough to pay rent," Dad yelled, "and she can pay it somewhere else."
At first, Mother argued with him, but within minutes, he'd convinced her. I'd been standing in the kitchen, weighing my options, thinking about how I'd just given Dad $400, a third of my savings, when Mother turned to me and said, "Do you think you could move out by Friday?" Something broke in me, a dam or a levee. I felt tossed about, unable to hold myself in place. I screamed, but the screams were strangled. I was drowning. I had nowhere to go. I couldn't afford to rent an apartment, and even if I could, the only apartments for rent were in town. Then I'd need a car. I had only $800. I sputtered all this at Mother, then ran to my room and slammed the door. She knocked moments later. "I know you think we're being unfair," she said, But when I was your age, I was living on my own, getting ready to marry your father. You were married at 16? I said. Don't be silly, she said. You are not 16. I stared at her. She stared at me. Yes, I am. I'm 16. She looked me over. You're at least 20. She cocked her head. Aren't you? We were silent. My heart pounded in my chest. I turned 16 in September, I said. Oh. Mother bit her lip, then she stood and smiled. Well, don't worry about it then. You can stay. Don't know what your dad was thinking, really. I guess we forgot. Hard to keep track of how old you kids are. Sean returned to work, hobbling unsteadily. He wore an Aussie Outback hat, which was large, wide-brimmed, and made of chocolate-brown, oiled leather. Before the accident, he had worn the hat only when riding horses, but now he kept it on all the time, even in the house, which Dad said was disrespectful. Disrespecting Dad might have been the reason Sean wore it, but I suspect another reason was that it was large and comfortable and covered the scars from his surgery. He worked short days at first. Dad had a contract to build a milking barn in Oneida County, about 20 miles from Buck's Peak, so Sean puttered around the yard, adjusting schematics and measuring I-beams. Luke, Benjamin, and I were scrapping. Dad had decided it was time to salvage the angle iron stacked all around the farm. To be sold, each piece had to measure less than 4 feet. Sean suggested we use torches to cut the iron, but Dad said it would be too slow and cost too much in fuel. A few days later, Dad came home with the most frightening machine I'd ever seen. He called it the shear. At first glance, it appeared to be a 3-ton pair of scissors, and this turned out to be exactly what it was. The blades were made of dense iron, 12 inches thick and 5 feet across. They cut not by sharpness, but by force and mass. They bit down, their great jaws propelled by a heavy piston attached to a large iron wheel. The wheel was animated by a belt and motor, which meant that if something got caught in the machine, it would take anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute to stop the wheel and halt the blades. Up and down they roared, louder than a passing train as they chewed through iron as thick as a man's arm. The iron wasn't being cut so much as snapped. Sometimes it would buck, propelling whoever was holding it toward the dull, chomping blades. Dad had dreamed up many dangerous schemes over the years, but this was the first that really shocked me. Perhaps it was the obvious lethality of it, the certainty that a wrong move would cost a limb. Or maybe that it was utterly unnecessary. It was indulgent, like a toy, if a toy could take your head off. Sean called it a death machine and said Dad had lost what little sense he'd ever had.
Are you trying to kill someone? He said. Because I got a gun in my truck that will make a lot less mess.
Dad couldn't suppress his grin. I'd never seen him so enraptured. Sean lurched back to the shop, shaking his head. Dad began feeding iron through the shear. Each length bucked him forward, and twice he nearly pitched head first into the blades. I jammed my eyes shut, knowing that if Dad's head got caught, the blades wouldn't even slow, just hack through his neck and keep chomping. Now that he was sure the machine worked, Dad motioned for Luke to take over, and Luke, ever eager to please, stepped forward. 5 minutes later, Luke's arm was gashed to the bone, and he was running toward the house, blood spurting. Dad scanned his crew. He motioned to Benjamin, but Benjamin shook his head, saying he liked his fingers attached, thanks anyway. Dad looked longingly at the house, and I imagined him wondering how long it would take Mother to stop the bleeding. Then his eyes settled on me.
Come here, Tara.
I didn't move.
Get over here, he said.
I stepped forward slowly, not blinking, watching the shear as if it might attack. Luke's blood was still on the blade. Dad picked up a 6-foot length of angle iron and handed me the end.
Keep a good hold on it, he said. But if it bucks, let go.
The blades chomped, growling as they snapped up and down. A warning, I thought, like a dog's snarl, to get the hell away. But Dad's mania for the machine had carried him beyond the reach of reason.
"It's easy," he said.
I prayed when I fed the first piece to the blades. Not to avoid injury, there was no possibility of that, but that the injury would be like Luke's, a wedge of flesh, so I could go to the house too. I chose smaller pieces, hoping my weight could control the lurch. Then I ran out of small pieces. I picked up the smallest of what was left, but the metal was still thick. I shoved it through and waited for the jaws to crash shut. The sound of solid iron fracturing was thunderous. The iron bucked, tossing me forward so both my feet left the ground. I let go and collapsed in the dirt, and the iron, now free and being chewed violently by the blades, launched into the air, then crashed down next to me.
"What the hell is going on?"
Sean appeared in the corner of my vision. He strode over and pulled me to my feet, then spun around to face Dad.
5 minutes ago, this monster nearly ripped Luke's arm off. So you've put Tara on it?"
"She's made of strong stuff," Dad said, winking at me.
Sean's eyes bulged. He was supposed to be taking it easy, but he looked apoplectic.
"It's going to take her head off," he screamed.
He turned to me and waved toward the iron worker in the shop.
"Go make clips to fit those purlins. I don't want you coming near this thing again."
Dad moved forward.
"This is my crew. You work for me, and so does Tara. I told her to run the shear, and she will run it."
They shouted at each other for 15 minutes. It was different from the fights they'd had before. This was unrestrained somehow, hateful. I'd never seen anyone yell at my father like that, and I was astonished by, then afraid of, the change it wrought in his features. His face transformed, becoming rigid, desperate. Sean had awoken something in Dad, some primal need. Dad could not lose this argument and save face. If I didn't run the shear, Dad would no longer be Dad. Sean leapt forward and shoved Dad hard in the chest. Dad stumbled backward, tripped, and fell. He lay in the mud, shocked for a moment. Then he climbed to his feet and lunged toward his son. Sean raised his arms to block the punch, but when Dad saw this, he lowered his fists, perhaps remembering that Sean had only recently regained the ability to walk.
"I told her to do it, and she will do it," Dad said, low and angry. "Or she won't live under my roof."
Sean looked at me. For a moment, he seemed to consider helping me pack. After all, he had run away from Dad at my age. But I shook my head. I wasn't leaving, not like that. I would work the shear first, and Sean knew it. He looked at the shear, then at the pile next to it, about 50,000 pounds of iron.
"She'll do it," he said.
Dad seemed to grow 5 inches. Sean bent unsteadily and lifted a piece of heavy iron, then heaved it toward the shear.
"Don't be stupid," Dad said.
"If she's doing it, I'm doing it,"
Sean said. The fight had left his voice. I'd never seen Sean give way to Dad, not once, but he'd decided to lose this argument. He understood that if he didn't submit, I surely would.
"You're my foreman," Dad shouted. "I need you in Oneida, not mucking with scrap."
"Then shut down the shear."
Dad walked away cursing, exasperated, but probably thinking that Sean would get tired and go back to being foreman before supper. Sean watched Dad leave. Then he turned to me and said,
"Okay, Sidolis, you bring the pieces and I'll feed them through. If the iron is thick, say a half inch, I'll need your weight on the back to keep me from getting tossed into the blades. Okay?"
Sean and I ran the shear for a month. Dad was too stubborn to shut it down, even though it cost him more to have his foreman salvaging than it would have cost him to cut the iron with torches. When we finished, I had some bruises, but I wasn't hurt. Sean seemed bled of life. It had only been a few months since his fall from the pallet, and his body couldn't take the wear. He was cracked in the head many times when a length of iron bucked at an unexpected angle. When that happened, he'd sit for a minute in the dirt, his hands over his eyes. Then he'd stand and reach for the next length. In the evenings, he lay on the kitchen floor in his stained shirt and dusty jeans, too weary even to shower. I fetched all the food and water he asked for. Sadie came most evenings, and the two of us would run side by side when he sent us for ice, then to remove the ice, then to put the ice back in. We were both fish eyes. The next morning, Sean and I would return to the shear, and he would feed iron through its jaws, which chewed with such force that it pulled him off his feet, easily, playfully, as if it were a game, as if he were a child. Chapter 16. Disloyal Man, Disobedient Heaven. Construction began on the milking barn in Oneida. Sean designed and welded the main frame, the massive beams that formed the skeleton of the building. They were too heavy for the loader, only a crane could lift them. It was a delicate procedure, requiring the welders to balance on opposite ends of a beam while it was lowered onto columns, then welded in place. Sean surprised everyone when he announced that he wanted me to operate the crane.
"Tara can't drive the crane," Dad said. "It'll take half the morning to teach her the controls, and she still won't know what the hell she's doing." "But she'll be careful," Sean said. "And I'm done falling off shit."
An hour later, I was in the man box, and Sean and Luke were standing on either end of a beam, 20 feet in the air. I brushed the lever lightly, listening as the hydraulic cylinders hissed softly to protract.
"Hold!"
Sean shouted when the beam was in place, when they knotted their helmets down and began to weld. My operating the crane was one of 100 disputes between Dad and Sean that Sean won that summer. Most were not resolved so peacefully. They argued nearly every day about a flaw in the schematics or a tool that had been left at home. Dad seemed eager to fight, to prove who was in charge. One afternoon, Dad walked over and stood right next to Sean, watching him weld. A minute later, for no reason, he started shouting that Sean had taken too long at lunch, that he wasn't getting the crew up early enough or working us hard enough. Dad yelled for several minutes, then Sean took off his welding helmet, looked at him calmly, and said,
"You gonna shut up so I can work?"
Dad kept yelling. He said Sean was lazy, that he didn't know how to run a crew, didn't understand the value of hard work. Sean stepped down from his welding and ambled over to the flatbed pickup. Dad followed, still hollering. Sean pulled off his gloves, slowly, delicately, one finger at a time, as if there weren't a man screaming 6 inches from his face. For several moments, he stood still, letting the abuse wash over him. Then he stepped into the pickup and drove off, leaving Dad to shout at the dust. I remember the awe I felt as I watched that pickup roll down the dirt road. Sean was the only person I had ever seen stand up to Dad, the only one whose force of mind, whose sheer tonnage of conviction, could make Dad give way. I had seen Dad lose his temper and shout at every one of my brothers, but Sean was the only one I ever saw walk away. It was a Saturday night. I was at Grandma over in Towns, my math book propped open on the kitchen table, a plate of cookies next to me. I was studying to retake the ACT. I often studied at Grandma's so Dad wouldn't lecture me. The phone rang. It was Sean. Did I want to watch a movie? I said I did, and a few minutes later I heard a loud rumble and looked out the window. With his booming black motorcycle and his wide-brimmed Aussie hat, he seemed entirely out of place, parking parallel to Grandma's white picket fence. Grandma started making brownies, and Sean and I went upstairs to choose a movie. We paused the movie when Grandma delivered the brownies. We ate them in silence, our spoons clicking loudly against Grandma's porcelain plates.
"You'll get your 27,
Sean said suddenly when we'd finished. "It doesn't matter," I said. "I don't think I'll go either way. What if Dad's right? What if I get brainwashed? Sean shrugged.
You're as smart as Dad. If Dad's right, you'll know when you get there.
The movie ended. We told Grandma goodnight. It was a balmy summer evening, perfect for the motorcycle, and Sean said I should ride home with him. We'd get the car tomorrow. He revved the engine, waiting for me to climb on. I took a step toward him, then remembered the math book on Grandma's table. You go, I said. I'll be right behind you. Sean yanked his hat down on his head, spun the bike around, and charged down the empty street. I drove in a happy stupor. The night was black, that thick darkness that belongs only in backcountry, where the houses are few and the streetlights fewer, where starlight goes unchallenged. I navigated the winding highway as I'd done numberless times before, racing down the Bear River Hill, coasting through the flat stretch parallel to Five Mile Creek. Up ahead, the road climbed and bent to the right. I knew the curve was there without looking for it, and wondered at the still headlights I saw shining in the blackness. I began the ascent. There was a pasture to my left, a ditch to my right. As the incline began in earnest, I saw three cars pulled off near the ditch. The doors were open, the cab lights on. Seven or eight people huddled around something on the gravel. I changed lanes to drive around them, but stopped when I saw a small object lying in the middle of the highway. It was a wide-brimmed Aussie hat. I pulled over and ran toward the people clustered by the ditch. Sean! I shouted. The crowd parted to let me through. Sean was face down on the gravel, lying in a pool of blood that looked pink in the glare from the headlights. He wasn't moving.
He hit a cow coming around the corner, a man said. It's so dark tonight he didn't even see it. We've called an ambulance. We don't dare move him.
Sean's body was contorted, his back twisted. I had no idea how long an ambulance might take, and there was so much blood. I decided to stop the bleeding. I dug my hands under his shoulder and heaved, but I couldn't lift him. I looked up at the crowd and recognized a face. Dwayne. Asked 15 years later, Dwayne did not recall being there, but he is there vividly in my memory. He was one of us. Mother had midwifed four of his eight children.
Dwayne, help me turn him.
Dwayne hefted Sean onto his back. For a second that contained an hour, I stared at my brother, watching the blood trickle out of his temple and down his right cheek, pouring over his ear and onto his white t-shirt. His eyes were closed, his mouth open. The blood was oozing from a hole the size of a golf ball in his forehead. It looked as though his temple had been dragged on the asphalt, scraping away skin, then bone. I leaned close and peered inside the wound. Something soft and spongy glistened back at me. I slipped out of my jacket and pressed it to Sean's head. When I touched the abrasion, Sean released a long sigh and his eyes opened.
Sid Lister,
he mumbled. Then he seemed to lose consciousness. My cell phone was in my pocket. I dialed. Dad answered. I must have been frantic, sputtering. I said Sean had crashed his bike, that he had a hole in his head.
Slow down. What happened?
I said it all a second time.
What should I do?
Bring him home, Dad said. Your mother will deal with it.
I opened my mouth, but no words came out. Finally, I said,
I'm not joking. His brain, I can see it.
Bring him home, Dad said. Your mother can handle it.
Then the dull drone of a dial tone. He'd hung up. Dwayne had overheard.
I live just through this field, he said. Your mother can treat him there.
No, I said. Dad wants him home. Help me get him in the car.
Sean groaned when we lifted him, but he didn't speak again. Someone said we should wait for the ambulance. Someone else said we should drive him to the hospital ourselves. I don't think anyone believed we would take him home, not with his brain dribbling out of his forehead. We folded Sean into the back seat. I got behind the wheel, and Dwayne climbed in on the passenger side. I checked my rearview mirror to pull onto the highway, then reached up and shoved the mirror downward so it reflected Sean's face, blank and bloodied. My foot hovered over the gas.
3 seconds passed, maybe four. That's all it was. Dwayne was shouting, "Let's go!" But I barely heard him. I was lost to panic. My thoughts wandered wildly, feverishly, through a fog of resentment. The state was dreamlike, as if the hysteria had freed me from a fiction that, 5 minutes before, I had needed to believe. I had never thought about the day Sean had fallen from the pallet. There was nothing to think about. He had fallen because God wanted him to fall. There was no deeper meaning in it than that. I had never imagined what it would have been like to be there, to see Sean plunge, grasping at air, to watch him collide, then fold, then lie still. I had never allowed myself to imagine what happened after, Dad's decision to leave him by the pickup, or the worried looks that must have passed between Luke and Benjamin. Now, staring at the creases in my brother's face, each a little river of blood, I remembered. I remembered that Sean had sat by the pickup for a quarter of an hour, his brain bleeding. Then he'd had that fit, and the boys had wrestled him to the ground so that he'd fallen, sustained a second injury, the injury the doctors said should have killed him. It was the reason Sean would never quite be Sean again. If the first fall was God's will, whose was the second? I'd never been to the hospital in town, but it was easy to find. Dwayne had asked me what the hell I was doing when I flipped a U-turn and accelerated down the hillside. I'd listened to Sean's shallow breathing as I raced through the valley, along Five Mile Creek, then shot up the Bear River Hill. At the hospital, I parked in the emergency lane, and Dwayne and I carried Sean through the glass doors. I shouted for help. A nurse appeared, running, then another. Sean was conscious by then. They took him away, and someone shoved me into the waiting room. There was no avoiding what had to be done next. I called Dad.
"You're nearly home," he said.
"I'm at the hospital." There was silence. Then he said,
"We're coming."
15 minutes later, they were there, and the three of us waited awkwardly together, me chewing my fingernails on a pastel blue sofa, Mother pacing and clicking her fingers, and Dad sitting motionless beneath a loud wall clock. The doctor gave Sean a CAT scan. He said the wound was nasty, but the damage was minimal. And then I remembered what the last doctor had told me, that with head injuries, often the ones that look the worst are actually less severe, and I felt stupid for panicking and bringing him here. The hole in the bone was small, the doctor said. It might grow over on its own, or a surgeon could put in a metal plate. Sean said he'd like to see how it healed, so the doctor folded the skin over the hole and stitched it. We took Sean home around 3 in the morning. Dad drove, with Mother next to him, and I rode in the back seat with Sean. No one spoke. Dad didn't yell or lecture. In fact, he never mentioned that night again. But there was something in the way he fixed his gaze, never looking directly at me, that made me think a fork had come along in the road, and I'd gone one way, and he the other. After that night, there was never any question of whether I would go or stay. It was as if we were living in the future, and I was already gone. When I think of that night now, I don't think of the dark highway or of my brother lying in a pool of his own blood. I think of the waiting room, with its ice-blue sofa and pale walls. I smell its sterilized air. I hear the ticking of a plastic clock. Sitting across from me is my father, and as I look into his worn face, it hits me. A truth so powerful, I don't know why I've never understood it before. The truth is this, that I am not a good daughter. I am a traitor, a wolf among sheep. There is something different about me, and that difference is not good. I want to bellow, to weep into my father's knees and promise never to do it again. But wolf that I am still above lying, and anyway, he would sniff the lie. We both know that if I ever again find Sean on the highway, soaked in crimson, I will do exactly what I have just done. I am not sorry. Merely ashamed. The envelope arrived 3 weeks later, just as Sean was getting back on his feet. I tore it open, feeling numb, as if I were reading my sentence after the guilty verdict had already been handed down. I scanned down to the composite score. 28. I checked it again. I checked my name. There was no mistake. Somehow, and a miracle was the only way I could account for it, I'd done it. My first thought was a resolution. I resolved to never again work for my father. I drove to the only grocery store in town, called Stokes, and applied for a job bagging groceries. I was only 16, but I didn't tell the manager that, and he hired me for 40 hours a week. My first shift started at 4 o'clock the next morning. When I got home, Dad was driving the loader through the junkyard. I stepped onto the ladder and grabbed hold of the rail. Over the roar of the engine, I told him I'd found a job, but that I would drive the crane in the afternoons until he could hire someone. He dropped the boom and stared ahead.
"You've already decided,"
he said without glancing at me.
"No point dragging it out."
I applied to BYU a week later. I had no idea how to write the application, so Tyler wrote it for me. He said I'd been educated according to a rigorous program designed by my mother, who'd made sure I met all the requirements to graduate. My feelings about the application changed from day to day, almost from minute to minute. Sometimes I was sure God wanted me to go to college because he'd given me that 28. Other times I was sure I'd be rejected and that God would punish me for applying, for trying to abandon my own family. But whatever the outcome, I knew I would leave. I would go somewhere, even if it wasn't to school. Home had changed the moment I'd taken Sean to that hospital instead of to Mother. I had rejected some part of it. Now, it was rejecting me. The admissions committee was efficient. I didn't wait long. The letter arrived in a normal envelope. My heart sank when I saw it. Rejection letters are small, I thought. I opened it and read, "Congratulations." I'd been admitted for the semester beginning January 5th. Mother hugged me. Dad tried to be cheerful.
"It proves one thing, at least," he said. "Our homeschool is as good as any public education."
3 days before I turned 17, Mother drove me to Utah to find an apartment. The search took all day, and we arrived home late to find Dad eating a frozen supper. He hadn't cooked it well, and it was mush. The mood around him was charged, combustible. It felt like he might detonate at any moment. Mother didn't even kick off her shoes, just rushed to the kitchen and began shuffling pans to fix a real dinner. Dad moved to the living room and started cursing at the VCR. I could see from the hallway that the cables weren't connected. When I pointed this out, he exploded. He cussed and waved his arms, shouting that in a man's house, the cable should always be hooked up, that a man should never have to come into a room and find the cables to his VCR unhooked. Why the hell had I unhooked them anyway? Mother rushed in from the kitchen. "I disconnected the cables," she said. Dad rounded on her, sputtering.
"Why do you always take her side? A man should be able to expect support from his wife."
I fumbled with the cables while Dad stood over me, shouting. I kept dropping them. My mind pulsed with panic, which overpowered every thought so that I could not even remember how to connect red to red, white to white. Then it was gone. I looked up at my father, at his purple face, at the vein pulsing in his neck. I still hadn't managed to attach the cables. I stood, and once on my feet, didn't care whether the cables were attached. I walked out of the room. Dad was still shouting when I reached the kitchen. As I moved down the hall, I looked back. Mother had taken my place, crouching over the VCR, groping for the wires, as Dad towered over her. Waiting for Christmas that year felt like waiting to walk off the edge of a cliff. Not since Y2K had I felt so certain that something terrible was coming, something that would obliterate everything I'd known before. And what would replace it? I tried to imagine the future, to populate it with professors, homework, classrooms, but my mind couldn't conjure them.
There was no future in my imagination. There was New Year's Eve, then there was nothing. I knew I should prepare, try to acquire the high school education Tyler had told the university I had, but I didn't know how, and I didn't want to ask Tyler for help. He was starting a new life at Purdue. He was even getting married, and I doubted he wanted responsibility for mine. I noticed, though, when he came home for Christmas, that he was reading a book called Les Misérables, and I decided that it must be the kind of book a college student reads. I bought my own copy, hoping it would teach me about history or literature, but it didn't. It couldn't, because I was unable to distinguish between the fictional story and the factual backdrop. Napoleon felt no more real to me than Jean Valjean. I had never heard of either. Part 2. Chapter 17. To Keep It Holy. On New Year's Day, Mother drove me to my new life. I didn't take much with me, a dozen jars of home-canned peaches, bedding, and a garbage bag full of clothes. As we sped down the interstate, I watched the landscape splinter and barb, the rolling black summits of the Bear River Mountains giving way to the razor-edged Rockies. The university was nestled in the heart of the Wasatch Mountains, whose white massifs jutted mightily out of the earth. They were beautiful, but to me their beauty seemed aggressive, menacing. My apartment was a mile south of campus. It had a kitchen, living room, and three small bedrooms. The other women who lived there, I knew they would be women because at BYU all housing was segregated by gender, had not yet returned from the Christmas holiday. It took only a few minutes to bring in my stuff from the car. Mother and I stood awkwardly in the kitchen for a moment, then she hugged me and drove away. I lived alone in the quiet apartment for 3 days, except it wasn't quiet. Nowhere was quiet. I'd never spent more than a few hours in a city and found it impossible to defend myself from the strange noises that constantly invaded. The chirrup of crosswalk signals, the shrieking of sirens, the hissing of air brakes, even the hushed chatter of people strolling on the sidewalk. I heard every sound individually. My ears, accustomed to the silence of the peak, felt battered by them. I was starved for sleep by the time my first roommate arrived. Her name was Shannon, and she studied at the cosmetology school across the street. She was wearing plush pink pajama bottoms and a tight white tank with spaghetti straps. I stared at her bare shoulders. I'd seen women dressed this way before. Dad called them Gentiles, and I'd always avoided getting too near them, as if their immorality might be catching. Now, there was one in my house. Shannon surveyed me with frank disappointment, taking in my baggy flannel coat and oversized men's jeans. "How old are you?" she said. "I'm a freshman," I said. I didn't want to admit I was only 17 and that I should be in high school finishing my junior year. Shannon moved to the sink, and I saw the word juicy written across her rear. That was more than I could take. I backed away toward my room, mumbling that I was going to bed. "Good call," she said. "Church is early. I'm usually late." "You go to church?" "Sure," she said. "Don't you?" "Of course I do. But you really go?" She stared at me, chewing her lip, then said, "Church is at 8. Good night." My mind was spinning as I shut my bedroom door. How could she be a Mormon? Dad said there were Gentiles everywhere, that most Mormons were Gentiles, they just didn't know it. I thought about Shannon's tank and pajamas, and suddenly realized that probably everyone at BYU was a Gentile. My other roommate arrived the next day. Her name was Mary, and she was a junior studying early childhood education. She dressed like I expected a Mormon to dress on Sunday, in a floral skirt that reached to the floor. Her clothes were a kind of shibboleth to me. They signaled that she was not a Gentile, and for a few hours I felt less alone. Until that evening, Mary stood suddenly from the sofa and said, "Classes start tomorrow. Time to stock up on groceries."
She left and returned an hour later with two paper bags. Shopping was forbidden on the Sabbath. I'd never purchased so much as a stick of gum on a Sunday, but Mary casually unpacked eggs, milk, and pasta without acknowledging that every item she was placing in our communal fridge was a violation of the Lord's commandments. When she withdrew a can of Diet Coke, which my father said was a violation of the Lord's counsel for health, I again fled to my room. The next morning, I got on the bus going the wrong direction. By the time I'd corrected my mistake, the lecture was nearly finished. I stood awkwardly in the back until the professor, a thin woman with delicate features, motioned for me to take the only available seat, which was near the front. I sat down, feeling the weight of everyone's eyes. The course was on Shakespeare, and I'd chosen it because I'd heard of Shakespeare and thought that was a good sign. But now I was here, I realized I knew nothing about him. It was a word I'd heard, that was all. When the bell rang, the professor approached my desk. "You don't belong here," she said. I stared at her, confused. Of course I didn't belong, but how did she know? I was on the verge of confessing the whole thing, that I'd never gone to school, that I hadn't really met the requirements to graduate, when she added, "This class is for seniors." "There are classes for seniors?" I said. She rolled her eyes as if I were trying to be funny. "This is 382. You should be in 110. It took most of the walk across campus before I understood what she'd said. Then I checked my course schedule and, for the first time, noticed the numbers next to the course names. I went to the registrar's office, where I was told that every freshman-level course was full. What I should do, they said, was check online every few hours and join if someone dropped. By the end of the week, I'd managed to squeeze into introductory courses in English, American history, music, and religion, but I was stuck in a junior-level course on art in Western civilization. Freshman English was taught by a cheerful woman in her late 20s who kept talking about something called the essay form, which, she assured us, we had learned in high school. My next class, American history, was held in an auditorium named for the prophet Joseph Smith. I'd thought American history would be easy because Dad had taught us about the founding fathers. I knew all about Washington, Jefferson, Madison, but the professor barely mentioned them at all, and instead talked about philosophical underpinnings and the writings of Cicero and Hume, names I'd never heard. In the first lecture, we were told that the next class would begin with a quiz on the readings. For 2 days, I tried to wrestle meaning from the textbook's dense passages, but terms like civic humanism and the Scottish Enlightenment dotted the page like black holes, sucking all the other words into them. I took the quiz and missed every question. That failure sat uneasily in my mind. It was the first indication of whether I would be okay, whether whatever I had in my head by way of education was enough. After the quiz, the answer seemed clear. It was not enough. On realizing this, I might have resented my upbringing, but I didn't. My loyalty to my father had increased in proportion to the miles between us. On the mountain, I could rebel. But here, in this loud, bright place, surrounded by Gentiles disguised as saints, I clung to every truth, every doctrine he had given me. Doctors were sons of perdition. Homeschooling was a commandment from the Lord. Failing a quiz did nothing to undermine my new devotion to an old creed, but a lecture on Western art did. The classroom was bright when I arrived, the morning sun pouring in warmly through a high wall of windows. I chose a seat next to a girl in a high-necked blouse. Her name was Vanessa. "We should stick together," she said. "I think we're the only freshmen in the whole class." The lecture began when an old man with small eyes and a sharp nose shuttered the windows. He flipped a switch and a slide projector filled the room with white light. The image was of a painting. The professor discussed the composition, the brush strokes, the history. Then he moved to the next painting, and the next, and the next. Then the projector showed a peculiar image, of a man in a faded hat and overcoat. Behind him loomed a concrete wall. He held a small paper near his face, but he wasn't looking at it. He was looking at us. I opened the picture book I'd purchased for the class so I could take a closer look. Something was written under the image in italics, but I couldn't understand it. It had one of those black hole words right in the middle, devouring the rest. I'd seen other students ask questions, so I raised my hand. The professor called on me, and I read the sentence aloud. When I came to the word, I paused. "I don't know this word," I said. "What does it mean?" There was silence. Not a hush, not a muting of the noise, but utter, almost violent silence. No paper shuffled, no pencils scratched. The professor's lips tightened.
"Thanks for that," he said, then returned to his notes.
I scarcely moved for the rest of the lecture. I stared at my shoes, wondering what had happened, and why, whenever I looked up, there was always someone staring at me as if I was a freak. Of course, I was a freak, and I knew it, but I didn't understand how they knew it. When the bell rang, Vanessa shoved her notebook into her pack. Then she paused and said, "You shouldn't make fun of that. It's not a joke." She walked away before I could reply. I stayed in my seat until everyone had gone, pretending the zipper on my coat was stuck so I could avoid looking anyone in the eye. Then I went straight to the computer lab to look up the word Holocaust. I don't know how long I sat there reading about it, but at some point I'd read enough. I leaned back and stared at the ceiling. I suppose I was in shock, but whether it was the shock of learning about something horrific or the shock of learning about my own ignorance, I'm not sure. I do remember imagining for a moment not the camps, not the pits or chambers of gas, but my mother's face. A wave of emotion took me, a feeling so intense, so unfamiliar, I wasn't sure what it was. It made me want to shout at her, at my own mother, and that frightened me. I searched my memories. In some ways, the word Holocaust wasn't wholly unfamiliar. Perhaps Mother had taught me about it when we were picking rosehips or tincturing hawthorn. I did seem to have a vague knowledge that Jews had been killed somewhere long ago, but I'd thought it was a small conflict, like the Boston Massacre, which Dad talked about a lot, in which half a dozen people had been martyred by a tyrannical government. To have misunderstood it on this scale, 5 versus 6 million, seemed impossible. I found Vanessa before the next lecture and apologized for the joke. I didn't explain, because I couldn't explain. I just said I was sorry and that I wouldn't do it again. To keep that promise, I didn't raise my hand for the rest of the semester. That Saturday, I sat at my desk with a stack of homework. Everything had to be finished that day because I could not violate the Sabbath. I spent the morning and afternoon trying to decipher the history textbook without much success. In the evening, I tried to write a personal essay for English, but I'd never written an essay before, except for the ones on sin and repentance, which no one had ever read, and I didn't know how. I had no idea what the teacher meant by the essay form. I scribbled a few sentences, crossed them out, then began again. I repeated this until it was past midnight. I knew I should stop. This was the Lord's time. But I hadn't even started the assignment for music theory, which was due at 7 a.m. on Monday. The Sabbath begins when I wake up, I reasoned, and kept working. I awoke with my face pressed to the desk. The room was bright. I could hear Shannon and Mary in the kitchen. I put on my Sunday dress, and the three of us walked to church. Because it was a congregation of students, everyone was sitting with their roommates, so I settled into a pew with mine. Shannon immediately began chatting with the girl behind us. I looked around the chapel and was again struck by how many women were wearing skirts cut above the knee. The girl talking to Shannon said we should come over that afternoon to see a movie. Mary and Shannon agreed, but I shook my head. I didn't watch movies on Sunday. Shannon rolled her eyes. "She's very devout," she whispered. I'd always known that my father believed in a different god. As a child, I'd been aware that although my family attended the same church as everyone in our town, our religion was not the same. They believed in modesty. We practiced it. They believed in God's power to heal. We left our injuries.